We're talking about the role of diaper banks on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. These community-funded programs around the country provide free diapers and baby items to low-income families, and they've seen a spike in need in the pandemic. Closer to home, MVP Bucks superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo has raised the profile of diapers. He's headlining a diaper drive to help Milwaukee Diaper Mission. Is it difficult to afford diapers? Do you make hard choices in order to buy them? It's 800-642-1234. Joanne Samuel Goldblum is CEO of the National Diaper Bank Network. It's a nonprofit that seeks to eliminate diaper need, partnering with more than 200 diaper banks, diaper pantries, and food banks nationwide. Joanne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
We also have Megan Johnson with us, co-founder of Milwaukee Diaper Mission, a nonprofit formed last year to address the diaper and period supplies gap. Megan, welcome to you.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you.
Megan, let's start with you. Why did you start this nonprofit last year focused on diapers?
I discovered that Milwaukee did not have a diaper bank, and doing some research, learned about a lot of other diaper banks around the country and connected with the National Diaper Bank Network and realized that most major cities have a program like this and Milwaukee did not. So I decided to start one.
What is the need like? What have you seen since starting up the nonprofit?
The need is very great here in Milwaukee. We're one of the poorest and most segregated cities in the country, and diapers are a vital product that many, many families here need. One in three families in the United States struggles to afford enough diapers, and that's a pre-pandemic statistic. So the need is very great here, and we have our work cut out for us.
And so you have this warehouse then in Milwaukee. How many diapers are in it? What is that like? Can you take us on a tour?
Yes. So we have what we call a warehouse. It's actually more like an office, but we call it our warehouse. And it's only about 1,100 square feet. When we moved in last year, we outgrew it almost immediately. So right now, inside our space, we have about 80,000 diapers housed. And then we have a separate facility that is a cold storage facility with much more product stored. And we're waiting to move into a larger space so that we can really start making more of an impact in Milwaukee.
Joanne, when you hear of an upstart diaper bank like the one here in Milwaukee, what's some tips and advice you see on these new diaper banks just starting now?
Well, you know, first off, it's always really exciting to see people like Megan, taking this and running with it and creating something really important in their own communities. The advice we give is, advice that I think Megan followed really well, which is to know your community, to find out, do a needs assessment, find out if anybody is distributing diapers, and then find out who needs them. And that's really the important place to start. And then you really need to, as Megan has done, become a fixture in your community as a person who talks about diaper need, period poverty, and a lack of material basic needs. So those are really the things that people do to start. And, programs across the country range from, what Megan just described of having, a couple of spaces and sort of trying to figure out where the next big space is, to, really large organizations that have, thousands of square feet of, warehouse space and distribute, upwards of 1 million diapers a year.
Give us a sense then, Joanne, what is your role in a national network? What do you do?
So I do a lot of raising awareness. So I talk to a lot of people like we're doing now about the issue of diaper need and about the issue of poverty in the United States, because that's really what the issue of diaper need is. It is a direct correlation to poverty. And, in the United States, we really don't talk about that very much. And it's often sort of swept under the rug. So that's a big part of what I do. And then, we have a staff of 15 people. We do research. We're doing a nationwide economic analysis study, and we do policy work. We, work to both change local, and state laws and regulations, and also federal, because right now there is no federal support or subsidy for diapers or period products.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Joanne Samuel Goldblum, CEO of the National Diaper Bank Network. Megan Johnson is co-founder of Milwaukee Diaper Mission. You can join in. Have you needed diapers and not been able to get them? What should be done to improve access? Should schools give out free period products? Join in at 800-642-1234. Megan, you're 100% volunteer run, and you co-founded Milwaukee Diaper Mission with you and a family member. Is that sustainable?
That's a great question. Yes, I co-founded Milwaukee Diaper Mission with my cousin, and at the time, we were very fortunate to be able to work 100% on this project. And we now, hopefully, will be able to raise the funds and the support to be able to pay staff and to be able to move into a larger facility. And then, of course, we would be much more sustainable at that point.
You're also in the midst of a diaper drive. What does that entail?
We are very fortunate to have partnered with Mariah and Giannis and the Milwaukee Bucks, along with Nuna and Huggies, to raise funds and also collect diapers at all three home games here in Milwaukee at Fiserv Forum this week. So we had our first diaper collection last night at the Lakers game, and then we'll have two more this weekend on Friday and Saturday. And we have an ongoing online fundraiser where folks can send dollars so that we can turn them into diapers and make more of an impact here in the city.
Joann Huggies, Pampers, all of these big manufacturers and a lot of revenue in diapers, they're going to be needed. What is the role of manufacturers in getting these products to families who can't afford them?
So, Huggies is the founding sponsor of the National Diaper Bank Network, and we have been partnering with them since I founded the National Diaper Bank Network 10 years ago. Over the years, in the 10 years, they have donated more than 200 million diapers to the National Diaper Bank Network, and through that to diaper banks across the country. So, we really see them, Huggies is much more than a sponsor. They truly are a partner in working to end diaper need. And so I feel really, really lucky to have that relationship. It's really been such a wonderful thing, both for the work we do nationally and for local diaper banks.
We've seen such huge supply chain issues. We've seen a run on toilet paper. What have you seen in the area of diapers in these times in the pandemic?
I always pe people ask about this, and I always say, I'm a social worker. I'm not a logistics person, or we have seen, we certainly are hearing the same thing that everyone else is, that there are supply chain issues. We have found that we are able to get diapers. It's not always from the same manufacturers for the same place that we might have previously, but we have not been in a position where it is not possible to get diapers. So, that is our experience. I think that while some of it is supply chain, I think that some of it goes back to hoarding and people hearing that there's a problem and then buying more than they need.
We have Joanne Samuel Goldblum there, leads the National Diaper Bank Network. Megan Johnson with us leads the volunteer-run Milwaukee Diaper Mission. What has it been like for you to get diapers in the pandemic? Have you led a diaper drive in your community? What is the need like where you are and for baby supplies in general? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more conversation here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about nonprofits trying to eliminate diaper need in Milwaukee and across the U.S. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the National Diaper Bank Network, one in three families struggle to buy diapers. And they say government safety net programs do not recognize diapers as a basic need. We have Joanne Samuel Goldblum, who leads the National Diaper Bank Network, and Megan Johnson, who founded Milwaukee Diaper Mission last year. They stay with us. Let's bring on a caller now, Elena in Rolling Ground. Elena, hi, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering if any of the diaper banks also try to provide a couple dozen non-disposables and a couple of buckets and a lot of times if it's just pee, you can just rinse them out, and that could help bridge things and maybe be a educational link if it's not culturally insensitive, or for families that have support that could handle that. And anyway.
Elena, thank you for bringing cloth diapers up. Megan, go ahead.
Yeah, so we provide cloth and disposable diapers. As an organization, we believe very strongly in dignity of choice and making sure that families have every option presented to them. I'm a cloth diapering parent myself. I'm also a disposable diapering parent. So I believe there's space for both in parenting of young children. And as a pretty strong advocate of cloth diapers, that's really what brought me to launch Milwaukee Diaper Mission in the first place. So yes, we offer cloth diapers free to anyone who needs them. We offer education. We teach virtual classes to families and ongoing support. So if they ever have questions or need help, we are there for them.
Joanne, what is the network's position on cloth diapers?
Very much the same as what Megan just said. Most of our member diaper banks offer both cloth and disposable. The thing that we always say, though, just to sort of set the stage, according to the Real Diaper Association, which is the cloth diaper association in the United States, only about 10% of U.S. Americans use cloth. So I would say that's pretty well reflected in the diaper bank community in terms of what folks are asking for from diaper banks. But as I said, most of our diaper banks do offer cloth. And in some communities, it's interesting, actually, because it does seem to be sort of community to community. In some communities, cloth diapering is very well accepted. Lots of people do it, and it really works. And in some communities, that's just not the case. And that's pretty much what we see.
In the last moments, I want to turn to government. Joanne, many state governments are receiving an infusion of ARPA pandemic relief aid. Have you seen any movement towards states putting money into their diaper bank programs or using federal resources on diapers?
Yeah, actually we have, and some during COVID and some prior. So California, for example, has actually done a lot with funding diapers. They have done two different things. One is they created a diaper stipend, about $30 a month per diaper wearing child, for families who receive CalWORKs. They also have independently funded a number of diaper programs throughout the state of California. Connecticut has also used TANF dollars, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families dollars, to pay for diapers. And there has been now during COVID, a number of states, for example, Georgia just has announced that they will be putting ARPA money towards diapers. And there have been a number of other states as well. I do think that is really, really the direction that things are moving in. So I'm very, very optimistic about that.
Megan, I want to give the last word to you. What do you see as the next steps for Milwaukee Diaper Mission? And what would you say for people who do want to help?
So we always say that diaper banks run on diapers, dollars, and doers. So those three things are what we need most right now. People can donate diapers to us. People can send a monetary contribution to us. And then, of course, we need volunteers to help us package product and get it out the door. As I mentioned before, we are bursting at the seams in our current space. And so the next step is to find a much larger facility that we can not only accept more donations of diapers into and package, we can have volunteer shifts where, you know, local companies can bring in their staff to do a day of service. We can have school groups come in and help us. So that's really the vision for 2022, is locating a new space and raising the funds to be able to support it.
Megan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Joanne, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Megan Johnson is CEO and co-founder of Milwaukee Diaper Mission. Joanne Samuel Goldblum, CEO of the National Diaper Bank Network. For more information about their nonprofits, we have them at WPR.org/mornings. Now, a few teams might stand out when you consider the most successful programs in sports. The New York Yankees, the Packers, the U.S. Women's Soccer Team, UW-Whitewater Wheelchair Basketball could easily join the list. Megan Hart has more on the return of a program that's won a combined 16 national titles.
Three-time Paralympic gold medalist Christina Schwab says there's a common misconception that wheelchair basketball is a slow sport. But you don't have to watch the Warhawks for long to figure out that's anything but true. Schwab is a Wisconsin native and now head coach of the women's team at UW-Whitewater.
When you come and the first time you see wheelchair basketball, you're going to notice the chairs and you're going to notice like all the contact and people falling down. And then once you get past that kind of like, whoa moment, you're going to realize that it's basketball.
Maida McCabe fell in love with the sport for its physical nature.
There's moments where we're all diving for the ball, we're falling over, we're crashing into each other, so it's very, very intense, and that's part of the reason why I like it, just because I'm very competitive.
Like other players, the freshman from Washington, D.C. says the wheelchair basketball program is a big part of the reason she's at UW-Whitewater. She's getting ready to play her first college game, with eight teams from around the country descending on South Central Wisconsin for a tournament that starts tomorrow. McCabe and her teammates lifted weights and tuned up their wheelchairs on Friday.
15 seconds, let's go! Push yourself!
She's a little nervous, but excited too.
I'm confident that we will do well and that we've grown so much as a team that we're going to do amazing.
But even more experienced players haven't seen much competition recently. Last season was canceled due to COVID-19. Junior Grace Altrock says it was really tough when the pandemic cut the 2020 season short just before the national championship. She's looking forward to this weekend.
I have family coming up from Nebraska because that's where I'm originally from. And so it's my 10th year playing, and so I'm just really excited overall.
Before she started playing wheelchair basketball in sixth grade, Altrock says she sometimes felt left out since she couldn't participate in sports.
I immediately fell in love with the sport, knowing that there are people that are disabled like me and that I can do everything that I want to do, but I just do it in a different way.
Altrock said it was a huge honor when she was recruited to play at UW-Whitewater. The Warhawks began their adaptive recreation program in 1973, and now two banners hang in the gym, highlighting their many titles. The UW-Whitewater men and women last won championships in 2016 and 2014, respectively. Freshman Cameron Poole says it means a lot to wear the purple and white.
Just the legacy that other players left behind. Hopefully I'll leave one of my own behind too, maybe a championship or two, maybe three. But it just feels great to be able to play for a university that supports the wheelchair basketball team as much as the one here does.
And for the Illinois native, something else helped set UW-Whitewater apart.
You know, I came here and I was like, what differentiates Whitewater from like a University of Illinois or a University of Alabama? We're a D3 school, so they can't offer, you know, athletic scholarships. They don't have all the big fancy facilities, but they turn out Paralympic athletes like crazy.
Five former UW-Whitewater players were on the U.S. men's wheelchair basketball team that won a gold medal at the Tokyo Paralympics this year. Schwab was on the sidelines as a coach. Senior Ryan Gladchuk began attending wheelchair basketball camp at UW-Whitewater when he was 12. There are some strong collegiate programs out there, but at a recent practice, he said the Warhawks are way ahead of most opponents when it comes to legacy. The chemistry major and his teammates practice every weekday morning. Plus, they complete two lifting sessions and three scrimmages each week. Players say wheelchair basketball at UW-Whitewater is just like playing any other collegiate sport. For Gladcheck, that includes the rush he feels competing at home.
There's a whole gym cheering for you, and your first experience at a home tournament is just so much more fun. You have all your friends and family watching you play, and everything you've worked for is like they can finally show it.
The tournament will take place tomorrow and Saturday in Whitewater. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Be sure to stay with us as we get insights from a former Wisconsin State Supreme Court Justice and retired law professor about the use of self-defense in Kyle Rittenhouse's murder case. Have you been following the trial? What do you make of Rittenhouse's self-defense argument? What stands out to you and about the jury deliberations with wanting to see the video evidence? Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the Kyle Rittenhouse homicide trial with a distinguished law professor as jury deliberations continue. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A jury of 12 Kenosha County residents must decide whether the now 18-year-old Rittenhouse acted in self-defense when he fatally shot two men and wounded a third during protests for racial justice in Kenosha in the summer of 2020. Have you been following the trial? How do you feel about the testimony and what's transpired? What do you think of the self-defense argument? 800-642-1234. Janine Geske is a Marquette University Law School professor and former director of Marquette's Law School's Restorative Justice Initiative. She served as a justice on the state Supreme Court and a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. Justice Geske, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. When the jury started their deliberations this week, they received this 36-page document that contained all the legal principles and the definitions and the criteria that they should be using as they reach their decisions on the charges. This whole trial is really focused on self-defense. What should we understand about the term self-defense?
Well, not, you know, and it's interesting because the jury received a booklet with it all and then asked later for individual copies, which shows they're paying attention closely to what the judge has instructed. The complicated part of self-defense in a criminal trial is that if a defendant, in this case Kyle Rittenhouse, raises enough evidence to at least argue that there was a valid self-defense, the burden of proof switches to the state. So the state must prove a negative beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this case, must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Kyle Rittenhouse did not reasonably use self-defense. So if people have doubts whether it was reasonable or not, the jury is told to find him not guilty. So it's a very high burden. And, you know, in its own way, it's a complicated case because of all the videos and witnesses and different viewpoints. And the jury's obviously taking it very seriously.
The jury has sat there, and now they want to review that drone video evidence. What do you make of that?
Well, I actually predicted at the beginning that they would ask for more instructions and that they would do the video. They saw so many videos during that trial, both between the state presentation and the defense presentation, but they're focusing on the videos that show the shootings. And that tells me that they're looking very seriously at the charges. And if I were to guess, there is dissension among the jurors as to how they want to evaluate that testimony. So sometimes when some jurors feel one way and others feel the other, the best way for them to sort of argue to each other is to re-see the evidence, and that's what they've done. So I just think they're just very methodically going through the instructions and making the findings they must make.
Some legal experts say that this case really shows how blurry and fragile the lines have gotten when people pick up a gun in the name of self-defense, that the legal and moral concept of self-defense, this doctrine that is sacred, isn't really equipped to handle an area of, you know, this time we're living in of expanded gun rights. What do you make of that?
No, I think that's true. You know, self-defense was historically really was that there was some conflict going on, and, you know, the person who was being attacked or potentially being attacked used some lethal force to protect themselves. But now we have these cases, both this case and the Arbery case, where we have individuals who get involved in a volatile situation and have these guns and grab these guns. And the question is, when somebody reacts to that gun, whether or not the person who owns the gun can now say, I was reasonably afraid for my own safety. I think this is going to really cause us to take a look at, you know, what does the introduction of guns, and in this case a very serious gun, an AR-15, into a volatile situation, what does that do in terms of being able to later assert self-defense?
So certainly looking at, you know, what precedent does it set as well for other trials?
Well, that's right. I mean, you can take this to the next extreme, that if we had two individuals, both with AR-15s approaching each other, where is the self-defense? Can they both shoot the other because they thought that they might grab each other's guns? You know, and there really is no guidance on those. We've expanded the sense of Second Amendment and when people can carry these guns or take these guns. You know, clearly if Kyle Rittenhouse had not shown up that night with the AR-15, and even if he'd just shown up to be the medic he claimed that he wanted to be, we wouldn't be in this situation. But it was the insertion of that AR-15 in the situation that ultimately resulted in two people being killed and another person being seriously injured.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with former State Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske. She's also a Marquette University Distinguished Law School professor. You can weigh in, giving us legal insights into the Rittenhouse homicide trial as the jury deliberates now for a third day. Your insights as well, 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Matt is joining us from Nisida. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hello. So what concerns me most about the Kyle Rittenhouse case is the role the media may have played and how it could be influencing the jurors. For basically an entire year leading up to the trial, we heard that Kyle Rittenhouse had no family in Kenosha, that he had no reason to be there, that was wrong, that he transported his AR from Illinois to Wisconsin, and that was wrong. It was stored in Wisconsin. That he, you know, chased after the protesters, and that was wrong. There were a lot of things the media put out and influence public perception that's completely incorrect as revealed by the trial. And so far, Rittenhouse has broken zero laws once the judge threw out the possession of a weapon by a minor charge. I'm wondering how the guest feels the media may influence public perception and the jurors.
Matt, thank you. Go ahead, Justice Geske.
Sure. And those are all good questions in this time of social media and sort of unrestricted passing of information, wrong or right, through social media, there is that potential. I can only tell you that the jury has been very clearly instructed that they need to follow the laws that are being introduced. I was surprised that the trial judge did not sequester the jury, at least during the trial, because of all the social media. But it's within his discretion to allow the jurors to go home at night. The jurors all took an oath that they will follow the law and follow the evidence that's introduced. And they look like they're doing that. I mean, they're clearly not jumping to a conclusion or we would have had a verdict already. And but it is a problem. And it's a problem not only for the juror, but for the public generally to form their opinions when there's so much information right or wrong out in the stratosphere. And so it's made it more complicated to try a fair and impartial case when you have all the social media and the commentaries going on. But the things mentioned by the callers really don't go to the self-defense at the moment when the gun was shot. And that's what the jury's concentrating on. You know, when the individuals were approaching Kyle Rittenhouse, when he decided to grab the gun, when he decided to pull the trigger, that's what the jury's looking at to see what his mindset was and whether he was in a reasonable belief that his bodily safety was endangered at that time.
Going back to media, it's been interesting that anyone can watch wall-to-wall proceedings of this trial. And, you know, that too is a glimpse inside the courtroom that maybe people don't normally see. What has that done?
Well, it's interesting. Wisconsin was one of the early states to allow cameras in the courtroom. I became a judge 2 years before Judge Schrader, so I've been around as long. And early on, we had the Supreme Court in Wisconsin decided to allow cameras in the courtroom. I am a believer in that because I think it is it's important to have the public watching what's happening, understanding what's happening. And my experience is that most of the time, the lawyers and even the judge sort of ignore the cameras and try the case. But it gives people a sense of what happened in that courtroom instead of a few reporters reporting on it and then some verdict down the road. Now, that being said, in this case, there's been a lot of analysis. And the judge is quirky, I think. I think he's legally strong, but he's quirky. And so there's been a lot of attention spent to sort of his different kinds of approaches on things. But ultimately, I think, you know, people who wanted to hear could exactly hear what the jury heard and come to their own conclusions after listening to the instructions of whether Kyle Rittenhouse is guilty of these crimes or whether he exercised reasonable self-defense.
As you mentioned, quirky, let's talk more about Judge Schrader with Steve now in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi. What would you like to ask about the judge?
Yeah, you know, I watched not all the trial, but a significant portion of the trial. And what it reminded me of is a football game where one team is overmatched, and so they have to hold all the time. And then the people that are on the team that's holding are saying, hey, the referee is calling penalties on us. So that's why I look at the prosecution. It seemed like they didn't have much of a case. They were throwing Hail Marys out there, and the judge called him on it and, you know, verbally reprimanded him, I think, for 12 minutes or so. Is that common when a defense attorney or a prosecutor is breaking the rules of engagement of a hearing and that the judge would admonish someone that publicly in that way?
And that's a great question. I can tell you in a high-profile, challenging case, which this one is, a lot of them aren't, it is not unusual. I think I have described what the prosecutor was doing was particularly on trying to get the evidence about a prior statement by Kyle Rittenhouse about shooting shoplifters that, you know, he was clearly angry. He had ruled that that should not be admissible unless he decided differently in the trial, and the prosecution tried to slip it in without asking the court. And I agree with the judge that he had every right to be angry. One of the important parts to know about that is that his anger was not in front of the jury. The jury was out of the room, and he wanted to make it clear to the prosecutor he wasn't going to tolerate that. Those moments are not unusual in a high-stress, difficult case. And the defense has done a very good job of you know, preserving their record. The other thing I have want to comment on is a lot of those rulings have gone in favor of the defense instead of the prosecution. Hmm. And to me, part of that is the judge is trying to preserve the record. And what I mean by that is not to let there be a lot of appellate issues that a defendant can argue if he gets convicted. So, you know, there are a couple motions for mistrial, and those will be grounds for appeal if he gets convicted. But the judge has had a lot of rulings go against the state, and I think he's trying to slim down that case so that if there is a conviction, there isn't a likelihood reversal afterwards.
We have a former state Supreme Court Justice and law professor Jeanine Geske presenting her analysis of the Kyle Rittenhouse case proceedings. What do you think of the self-defense argument in this trial? How do you see Rittenhouse, a patriot, a vigilante, maybe neither? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Justice Geske here on the Ideas Network. We're getting reaction to the Rittenhouse trial and the self-defense argument in particular on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Wednesday, we saw the 12-member jury asked about viewing photos and drone video evidence as they attempted to find consensus over whether to convict or acquit Rittenhouse on 5 counts, including 2 homicide charges. How do you feel about the video evidence presented? What stands out? Are you a Kenosha County resident? What is it like to live in these times? Still time, 800-642-1234. Marquette Law School professor, former State Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske stays with us. We heard from Nancy in Verona, called in, couldn't stay with us, Justice. And Nancy wants to know what role multiple gunshots play in self-defense. How can Kyle Rittenhouse claim self-defense if he shot someone multiple times, Nancy asks.
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. And, you know, there were 4 shots fired in the one homicide. What the jury has to look at is what's reasonable under the circumstances. Now, you know, you could see, for example, when a police officer is defending himself or herself, it is not uncommon that there are multiple shots to make sure that, you know, somebody's no longer a threat. And Rittenhouse, that's what Rittenhouse was indicating, that he still believed after he had fired the first gun shot, that he still thought that his life was threatened. And so it's all into what 12 people believe was reasonable under the circumstances for Kyle Rittenhouse to believe. That certainly was a strong argument that the state has that I think the first shot hit his pelvis and he was not armed, and the likelihood that he needed to put 3 more bullets in, one of which turned out to be the lethal bullet, was an excessive use of self-defense. But those are the kinds of questions the jury is fighting with back there and trying to get their arms around. And they're not simple questions, and they're not the kinds of questions that we've answered in the past in other self-defense cases.
Nancy, thank you for that question. Let's go to Mary now in Madison. Hi, Mary. What would you like to ask?
Good morning. I wanted to ask about how the gun, the AR-15, became legal. It's a minor with this gun, and it seemed the law that this team of lawyers found this loophole or looked at Wisconsin law, and somehow the judge was willing to consider this gun as almost like a hunting gun, and the guy wasn't there for hunting. So could you comment on that?
Sure. Excellent question. And I have to tell you I had the same reaction you did when I heard that he had done that. So I also took a look at the statute. And I will tell you that in reading the statute and listening to the judge's ruling, I happen to think he made the right ruling. And let me explain why. The statute initially says that a minor cannot possess a dangerous weapon, and it lists what a dangerous weapon is. But then in that same statute, there's a provision that a minor may possess a rifle or a long gun if it is the standard length of a gun. So what it prohibits for minors are what we basically call sawed-off shotguns or shortened barrels, and those are illegal for minors. I believe the reason for that statute, and, you know, no one's had time, including me, to go back and research it, was that the legislature did not want to criminalize farm kids that used a gun on the farms or hunting kinds of situations where minors will often have rifles or long guns. And so that's how the statute reads. The only way that you can criminalize what Rittenhouse had in terms of a weapon would be for the legislature to change the statute. But the judge's role is that to apply the law as it's written by the legislature, and it actually does say what the judge said. It said how everybody missed it and the argument wasn't made earlier, I don't know. I think they probably weren't concentrating on it because it was a smaller charge compared to everyone else. But it was not as bizarre a ruling as it looked at first blush.
Mary, thank you for that question as we talk with former State Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske about the Rittenhouse trial. With your questions along the way here, Bruce now in Viroqua. Bruce, hi, what would you like to ask?
Hi, I just wasn't sure if the jury was able to get the information of what happened after he was bailed for, what was it, $2+ million. He was spotted in a bar with the Proud Boys, who've been designated as a hate group, basically a neo-Nazi group, flashing white power symbols, wearing a shirt that says free as F. And I wonder if the jury has that information. If not, why not? It seems like it goes to show the larger picture of, like, he is basically an extremist coming to town with the AR-15 and, you know, basically a right-wing extremist.
Bruce, thank you. Justice Geske.
Well, and that also is an excellent question. And the answer is no, the jury was not told that. When there are other acts, we call those other acts, other actions that may not be direct evidence of the incident, but they bear on the defendant's character and his background, the judge goes through a balancing test of how relevant the evidence is to the issues the jury has to decide and how unfairly prejudicial it might be to the defendant. And this is a big judgment call by a judge. A different judge may have very easily ruled differently, but this judge decided that was excluded, that the unfair prejudice was outweighed any probative value, as we say, or relevant value, that, you know, it was a removed time and that it didn't bear on whether or not he exercised reasonable self-defense at the time. So the jury did not get to hear that evidence. Mm.
Bruce, thank you. Tiffany now in Madison. Hi, Tiffany. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if the jury's able to consider what the victims thought. So if they thought that they were stopping a threat and that's why they approached Kyle Rittenhouse, if they're able to take that into consideration.
Well, really, that is the state's argument, but they really are not taking into consideration what was going through the victim's thoughts. The concentration is what was going through Kyle Rittenhouse's brain at the time. And, you know, I mean, that's what the prosecution tried to ask them about that. Don't you think that they were trying to protect themselves? Don't you think they were going after you because you just killed somebody? And that goes into whether he reasonably believed that he was using reasonable force in order to stop a threat to himself. So you really are concentrating not on the state of mind of the victim, but the state of mind of the offender. But you take that all into consideration as to what was reasonable under the circumstances. And the state makes a very strong argument that, you know, he couldn't assume that these people were trying to kill him. He should have realized or did realize they were simply trying to stop him as a threat and somebody who'd already shot and killed someone.
Justice Geske, thank you for fielding these questions. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Justice Jeanine Geske, Marquette University Law School professor, former director of its Restorative Justice Initiative, served as a justice of the state Supreme Court. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.